Welcome to Souls on Fire with your host, Joe Trainer. Joe is a husband and father of three, and for 29 years was an award-winning and very successful college football coach. Today, he is the director of athletics for Pope John Paul II High School. He is a leader, a man of character, and filled with the joy of the Lord. Joe was running for God's heart and became a soul on fire. Listen in every Monday as Joe interviews other sports figures and businessmen and women who bring their faith into the marketplace. And now, here's Joe Trainer.
It was an opportunity today to connect with, a select group of folks that I've journeyed with, and they've journeyed with me over the course of my career, and certainly since 9/11. So today was, again, without being dramatic, but there was a, kind of this invitation to reflect, and I'll share in a moment here, Joe, if you'd permit me, but there was this really powerful reflection that was written by an Army colonel, retired Army colonel, 36 years of service, that I did not serve with him. I've never met the man, but I know him by reputation, and he just had this beautiful reflection on the day and on what it meant, and it was just what this guy has done for our country was just remarkable. And so to hear his words, or rather to read his words and to feel the emotion today, it was just pretty powerful stuff.
That's awesome. Will you mind sharing that with us a little, some vignettes from there?
Yeah, absolutely. So just, Joe, quickly, this guy's name is Bill Ostolin. And again, retired Army colonel. He grew up in... he was an enlisted guy, grew up in the Range Regiment, and then went, became a commissioned officer as an infantryman, and then was in and out of special operations and then, conventional infantry forces. Specifically, he spent a lot of time in the airborne. And his unit, Joe, he commanded a battalion, so about 800 guys, and they fought in the mid-2000s in the Korangal Valley in Afghanistan. And what's remarkable about this guy's unit, Joe, it was a 15-month deployment. So this is when the military and the Army in particular, the Army had the longest deployments of any of the services by months. But the Army recognized that in order to achieve some of the operational objectives that they needed to surge forces and to leave forces in theater for a longer duration. So typically, the typical deployment was, at that point was about 12 months, but some units served 15, 17, 18 months. Just hearing this for context. So this guy's, on his particular deployment, and they fought in the Korangal Valley, which at the time was the most dangerous place in the world. Mm. And of the 800 guys that served with him, they 400 men, 400 paratroopers were awarded medals for valorous activity and behavior. And three of his members, Joe, three members of this one battalion earned the Medal of Honor.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's amazing. It, pound for pound, it is the most highly decorated battalion of any formation in the global war on terror.
Wow, that's impressive, man. Really impressive.
Yeah. But what he, last comment on this, but this is what I want to share with you and I want your people to hear. He wrote today about how he deployed six times
wow.
into combat.
Wow.
And many of those times Joe, and for your listeners, he was directly leading troops, right? So as a in a green tab, as a as in a commanding capacity.
Sure.
He's married and he's got three kids.
Oh.
He said that it was very painful for his wife and his kids to hear this, but when those units were formed and they were doing the deployment ceremony and the other families were there, okay, and this is part of our kind of part of our lore and part of what happens before a unit goes overseas is that there's a send-off ceremony. But what he routinely and without fail would commit to the families, he said, look, I love my wife and my three boys more than anything else in this world. But what I commit to the families and what I commit to my soldiers is that for the duration of our deployments, I will love you, my soldiers, more than anyone on this earth.
Wow.
And
that's crazy powerful, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I think
I appreciate
you
allowing me to share that.
Oh, man, I appreciate you sharing that. And I think, like, you know, you certainly have, you know, a number of civilian friends. And, you know, I think career military guys that are decorated war heroes like yourself and the guy you were just mentioning. You know, you've been living on that line for the better part of, you know, decades, right? And, you know, for most of us indulgent Americans, you know, that was kind of the, oh my gosh, on American soil, no less, and blah, blah, blah. But you know, every day you wake up, you know, in active duty or reserve duty, you know, there's like a hypervigilance for you because you know, based on what's happening around the world at any given point, you might be called to mission. And not that you resent, like, the rest of us that are kind of just it takes that like lightning bolt to be thrown from your horse in the form of a terroristic bomb or you know the tragedy, the multi-layered tragedy that happened at 9/11. But you know for those of you that have lived it for you know when you were you know a career military man, is it tough to to understand like a newfound passion or kind of galvanized effort for civilians? Do you know what I'm asking there?
No, Joe, I do. This is what I will share with you in response to that. And I appreciate that comment and the question. You know, Joe, one of the unintended consequences of, so Vietnam, coming out of Vietnam, the Vietnam War, which was highly unpopular, right? Highly unpopular war, and the military was completely demoralized. The country was demoralized coming out of Vietnam. So, well-intentioned, but what the military proposes and then gets accepted by the administration at the time was that, we're going to go with an all-volunteer force, okay? Which briefs really well. But one of the unintended consequences, Joe, was that It divorced the American people from military service.
So
okay?
True.
So what has happened in time since the advent of the all-volunteer force, again, which was in the 70s coming out of the Vietnam War, was that you've got a very, very small percentage of Americans that have worn the uniform, okay, and that have voluntarily put themselves in harm's way for the country. And what has happened further still is that as you extrapolate that out across time and space, is that it's the same families, Joe. Okay?
Yeah.
It's the Mannings. It's the Watkinsons, right? And this is with humility, but just using as
no
an example, okay? It's the same families. It became a family business. So no doubt, you know, that Americans, you know, and you and your family and our crew back in, you know, in Rhode Island, people genuinely and heartfelt cared for us and for my family. And as we were going out, and there was this high level of appreciation. And then it just became this forever war, right? It just, and not so gosh, we got tired as service members, and our families certainly got tired, and I think too much was asked of us. And I think over time, you know, Joe, one of the things that I think, again, it started off with the best intentions. But, you know, we used to do, and you may have participated in this, you know, in fact, I know you did at URI, and, you know, and Providence College. We would do these, you know, military appreciation games.
Yep.
And, you know, very early on, you know, in the war, and for the first, you know, 5 to 10 years, you know, I was, speaking appropriately, at PC, I was intimately involved in that, you know, trying to support that. It was a beautiful way, I think, to recognize the service and the sacrifice of a particular service member and their family. But, Joe, in time, you know, it was I look at it very differently now. And maybe because there was too many iterations of it. And I look at it, and it was not that we weren't glorifying war. That's the wrong way to phrase this or to capture this. But, Joe, I think it just became in time. The message got lost, it got blurred, and it was just too much. And so, you know,
yeah, what could leadership have done differently so that it wasn't? Because it was,
because,
you know, it's still you know, when you hear the phrase war on terror, we're still fighting it. And, you know, and to your point, it's like for those select number of families that were career military, you know, much like law enforcement, there were just a sense of patriotism and honor that came with that. But like what could be done, what could have been done differently, Mike, with knowing that the enemy was who the enemy was and their limited capacity to arm
what could
we have done differently, and what could we be doing differently now? Yeah. As you reflect back
this, on this, it. This is absolutely a conversation better had over a Guinness, right?
Or no doubt.
With your brother Luke and some Jameson. and, you know, and I think the bottom line is if you look at, we didn't ask enough. We asked too much of the military and not enough of the American people. Okay,
right,
and that was done very deliberately. That was a political decision that, you know, beginning with Bush and then carried on through the Obama administration. Not enough was asked of the American people. So, you know, you've heard this, right? You know, the military's at war and America's at the mall. And I don't fault, you know, I don't fault the average American. They weren't asked. But what has happened is that, again, we the same soldiers, the same service members, same families were once again into the breach. And so I think we needed, I don't know if it was a total mobilization, Joe, of the American of the American society, but you know, now we're getting in a little bit into national security decision making. But we didn't, even the other instruments of national power, we led with the military and, you know, the State Department and the other departments within the U.S. government did not do enough. And then of course, you know, 2 years ago, right, when we left Afghanistan, the way after 20 years, the way that we...
Yeah, that was embarrassing. Yeah.
It was cowardice. And we betrayed our partners in Afghanistan, and we absolutely broke the hearts. We broke the hearts of service members and their families that served there.
No doubt. Certainly, we could have hours-long conversation about that. More thing I just want to touch on before we move beyond the 9/11 celebration today is... You know, so I teach, you know, I do have the opportunity and the blessing to teach one class of freshman religion here at LaSalle High School. And, you know, certainly devoted the entire time with them today, and kind of a mixed bag in terms of what they were able to recall. You know, and then again, not being cliche here, but like those who forget the past are likely to repeat it. But, you know, what do you think we're doing enough to kind of keep that memory and the memorial alive, Mike, or just in terms of, you know, and again,
you know,
I definitely agree with what you're saying. More should have been asked for civilians without question. But I do reflect back on, you know, FDR had, you know, World War II, and, you know, I look back at that, and it wasn't long-lived, but, man, you're a Sox fan, I'm a Phillies fan, but, like, when New York was playing, you know, 2 days after, and, you know, that iconic, you know, celebration, you know, where they were wearing, you know, hats of policemen and firemen, and patriotism was incredibly high. It didn't matter if you were black or white or you know, Republican or Democrat. It just felt like, it was patriotism did pour out, and then, you know, shortly thereafter, it seems like the infighting began again, you know?
Right.
But are we doing enough to keep that memory alive, Mike?
I mean, Coach, I think we are, I think it's being paid the right amount of, I think people are, those of us that were old enough to remember it, right, are reverential with great reverence, you know, we kind of behold that day and that memory. Where I think, Coach, and again, this is a larger conversation, I think we've done such a poor job evangelizing and what it means to be an American, right?
Sure.
And again, this is a larger conversation, but gosh, what it means, like every service member swears an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. What does that mean? What are those ideals inherent in the Constitution? Most Americans don't even know what they are. They can't
no doubt
that, right? So I think where we've lost our way, Joe, and part of this was when we got out of the schools, right?
Yep.
But you know, beginning there, I think with each ensuing decade, we have lost our touch when it comes to what it means to be an American and American exceptionalism.
Yeah, and I feel like, and again, I feel like, maybe there's a part of me that's done a poor job with that, with identity politics and, you know, and kind of just focusing on things that, you know, that things that fracture us more than things that unite us. And, you know, I was reminded of that yesterday on the eve of the celebration, you know, the second reading from yesterday's Mass was Romans 13, 8 through 10, and it was basically, love fulfills the law. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other command there may be are summed up in this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. You know, and then follow up with, and who is my neighbor? You know, and then, you know, Christ comes back, you know, in a different passage of time, says, even the pagans love those that love them back. You know, I feel like, and again, I'm talking out both sides of my mouth, because identity politics, sometimes in my faith journey, prevents me from radical discipleship that Christ was talking about, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Joe, you know what came to mind as you were just reading that and talking was this idea of, you know, what he's talking about, right? He's not talking about philia or, you know, he's not talking about brotherly love. He's talking about agape.
No. Yep.
He's talking about unconditional love, right? And there's a huge distinction there, as you know as well as I do, and I think that's what he represents, that was the love that was manifest within him. And you know, that, as you said, that radical call to love, it's so radical. But if I think when it takes place, and I'm, you know, I'm still on my own faith journey, I'm not there, but you know, you see it in there are people that we know together and separately that have been able to get there. And
sure.
Certainly the saints, and there's people that, you know, walk among us today that have been able to love that way. And I think it's this idea of unconditional love, because when you love someone unconditionally, Joe, you're able to look beyond the differences and maybe your inclination to reject them.
Oh, brother, it is so hard to do that sometimes. And you know, you and I joke about our Irish heritage, right? Nobody's judging like the Irish. And
right.
It's, you know, whether it's inclusiveness, you know, agape, the unconditional love. And even with things like that, you know, I don't know. Like, I feel like sometimes fear is at the forefront for me, you know, and my, you know, my job is to, you know, as Christ tells us, he challenges us, is love everyone, right? Our job is to love everyone. And I find myself all too often, you know, not, you know, picking and choosing, you know, certain, you know, if you fit into a certain box, you know, and again, it's, I'm not talking about the marginalized that, you know, that, or the needy or the poor or the desolate, you know, it's certainly easy to love them and to be empathetic and to give them, you know, to model the Christ-like love that he showed us when he was here. But, you know, it's people that disagree with you, you know, that in identity and politics.
If I may jump in, just again, you know, something that just came to me and I want to share with you. So about a month ago, Joe, not even a month ago, 2 to 3 weeks ago, Father Chris Murphy, and you've met him and you know the name, Father Chris Murphy, who is the rector at Our Lady of Providence Seminary in Providence, Rhode Island, which is it's a minor seminary, okay? So we were down there. They got a great house this year. He's got 15 young men that are studying for the priesthood from a number of different dioceses across the Northeast. Really, it's really pretty remarkable. And so we were invited down to be part of the orientation and the onboarding of the men. And it was really special. It was a beautiful opportunity to come in, have a conversation with them. We talked a lot about, you know, team development and teaming and, you know, how you can hold each other accountable, et cetera. And one of the men, when we were talking about this idea of, like, what, you know, kind of base of the iceberg, Joe, kind of this deeply held belief, this mental model, you know, what needs to kind of underpin everything that the men do this year and how they communicate with each other, how they support each other, how they hold each other accountable. And this young man, Joe, he's 23 years old, Henrican grad, and he said this year we need to approach each other. We all need to embrace a spirit of intentional communion. A spirit of intentional communion, right? So this idea of I want to accompany you, and I may not agree with you, but I want to be present to you, and I want to walk with you. You know, when I heard that, it was pretty profound, you know, again, without being dramatic here, but it was, especially coming out of the mouth of a 23-year-old. And I think that's the key, you know, is surrendering to that, because we work with, we come in contact with people that look at the world very, very differently than we do, different belief system, you know, subscribing to a different ideology. But if we reject Joe, and if we don't, again, and I'm not preaching here, but if we don't, if we're not going to be willing to accompany them, to be present to them, to be open to them, you know, it's if we're not going to do this, you know, all doors are closed.
Man, that's crazy powerful. And as you're saying that, Mike, I'm you know, it's my fear, you know, too often that prevents me from doing that, right? I mean, I feel like if I do that, you know, and don't go, you know, how do you welcome that, those people to the table who, I guess it's total surrender. We both know, and I know you've had crazy powerful influences on your life of people that have been able to surrender in totality. I feel like I'm like 75% surrendered, and again, I feel like, you know, we're so caught up in, you know, interpreting the Bible in the 21st century and how that plays out. But, you know, the formula is not, I mean, for all of, I mean, I'm thinking of that reading from yesterday. It's like, you know, Augustine said it too, like, hey man, when you get caught up in like creation or commandments or all that stuff, he's like, just love is the default button, right? Love is your, you know, just your reset. And I feel like today, like, it's just so convoluted with, like, you know, with medicine and technology and our ability to play God in so many ways. Mm-hmm. I almost feel like, and this is dead wrong, I get this, but, like, silence is complicit. And I feel like that's what I'm holding on mm-hmm. to, my fear of that. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. That's it. I mean, because I'm rambling a little bit, but I'm like, as I'm thinking, you're helping me to drill down further. But like, I'm afraid if I, and I know the cliche, right? They love the sinner, hate the sin. I get, you know, I can't even go there. Like, that's great, but like, on a fundamental, rudimentary level, you know, I feel like some of the rules or some of the interpretations that prevent me from doing that in terms of total surrender.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. I got you. You know, I think, you know, Bishop Barron, Joe, I recently read, you know, my mom had sent something along, and he talked about, you know, if we look at the way Jesus did this, right? He, he's the model, but everyone with whom he came in contact, he did, I think, embrace them literally and figuratively speaking with, you know, with love, and, you know, embracing that mission of being present. But it was also, right, he challenged everyone. He always represented the truth, but he challenged everyone to, you know, to live their lives you know, better, to begin again and to move away from sin and towards, you know, towards God. And I think, and again, Joe, I haven't figured this out, you know, but I think that, you know, that's the aim point right there is, which I love because, you know, Joe, a lot of, and even in Catholic Christian circles, it's like, well, Christ was, you know, Christ, and you know, he embraced everyone, you know, and to include a sinner. Yeah, he did, but there was always the challenge of, hey, listen, you got to do better, right? You got to, no, you do not choose to live a life of sin. You know, you need to come to the truth and embrace a relationship with God. And I think, so how do you deliver that? So we have to be empathetic. We're not rejecting Joe, but I think we have to defend the truth and this idea of, you know, fraternal correction. Hey, look, you know, you and I have talked this piece before, separately but on this show. We have our mission. We've got to get our family, we got to get ourselves, we got to get our families, those we love, those, and I think it extends to those we come in contact with. It's part of representing the truth, Joe. We're trying to lead people to heaven, right?
No doubt.
I mean, I want to get there myself, right? And I'm not saying it's easy.
You and I are going to have a one-bedroom apartment up there. We're going to have to share the same bed. You know that, Mike, right?
So that's it. Yeah, hot. They call that hot bed. There's one bed.
You're on the fast monitor. I'm going to have a lot of stops before I get there.
Yeah.
Great stuff, man. Always. You know, you always challenge me to dig down and drill down, and I'm forever grateful for that. Folks, we're going to return after these brief messages with Colonel Mike Manning, and I want to get into a couple great topics, devotion to the Blessed Mother. And, Mike, I do want to touch on your new role with the Diocese of Boston when we get back, okay? We'll be right back after these messages, folks.
You're listening to In His Sign Catholic Radio, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. We are blessed to have had this Catholic radio apostolate for almost 40 years now. Thanks be to God for your partnership. Without you, this radio voice would be silenced. We have a monthly Mass offered for you, our loyal family of listeners. It's our way of saying thank you for underpinning our apostolate with your many prayers and financial support. This is your radio ministry, to be a voice for those who have no voice, to evangelize and to catechize for a time such as this. We know the Lord will bless you abundantly. He can never be outdone in generosity. If this ministry has touched your heart, help us to touch other hearts by supporting us with your prayers and financial support. Call us at 610-527-2906 or visit our website at inhissign.com.
Welcome back to Souls on Fire. I'm your host, Joe Traynor, here with Colonel Mike Manning, Professor of Leadership Studies at the Gordon Institute of Engineering at Northeastern University. Mike, I do want to talk about, initially this, I wanted to spend a lot of time on something that's near and dear to your heart, the devotion to the Blessed Mother. But there's a couple other things I do want to get to today before we end the program. But Mike, okay, one of the things, two of the areas that people that are critical of our faith in the Catholic on the Catholic faith, with saintly intercession and our devotion to the Blessed Mother, whether it's Faustina, Padre Pio, Saint John Paul II, there's 5,000, and again, I've always felt, and I know you feel, the beauty of the Catholicism. We get to engage in relationship with Christ and God through so many different platforms, right? Two of which are, the devotion to the Blessed Mother, and whether it's the novenas or the Rosary, and the saintly intercession, right? But what do you say? What do you say to the naysayers out there, Mike, that are hating on the Catholics and say, "Well, you may be spending." And I'm a huge, and I know Mother Olga and her, her faith journey. That I feel like I've become friends with her. Certainly a saint, a saintly woman here on earth. But what do you say to the haters, Mike, that say, "Oh, you're spending all this time when you could be praying directly to Christ or to God, Faustina or even the Blessed Mother"? What do you say to those people?
Yeah, Joe, I think, and I appreciate the question. What I share with them is, I'd say, look, how could we, for starters, how could we think that the Mother of Christ, okay, the Mother of Christ, and Jesus drew his humanity from Mary, right? The God man. So how could we conceive of her being, of course she was conceived without sin, right? Because she from her was brought forth her son, number one. Number two, there's a one of the great, I would pull forward, in response to your question, there was a very holy Jesuit priest by the name of Father John Harden, and he was very close to Mother Teresa. But he talked about how, and this aligns with Maximilian Kolbe and his understanding of the Blessed Mother. But the Blessed Mother, it we go to her because she dispenses of graces, right? So she serves as this mediatrix. She intervenes on our behalf. And so, yeah, of course you can go to God, and you should have a relationship with God and his son in Christ. But the mother, remember, Jesus never, you know, as Pope John Paul II said, never worry about loving Mary too much, because you can never love her more than Jesus does.
Mm.
And
I love
so,
that.
Right? Yeah, it's beautiful. And so with that in mind, you know, we love his, and by loving the mom, by loving his mom, we honor him. And so I love this image, Joe, of, you know, you think how much we love our own moms, our earthly mothers. But
sure.
This idea of Mary accompanies us, and she advocates for us. And so I like to, you know, it's consecrating ourselves, you know, to Jesus by, with, and through Mary. And I think I like to think of her as amplifying, you know, amplifying our messages and representing our needs. And I just, you know, I know how much I love my mom, my own mom. And it's just, for me, I think it's just such a beautiful gift that we have in the church.
I'm with you. And I, you know, as you're reflecting back on, you know, the graces, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, one of the promises, you know, Mary tells us that, you know, she gives us promises that for those of us that are devoted to her through this resuscitation of the rosary, whoever shall faithfully serve me by the resuscitation of the rosary shall receive signal graces.
Yeah.
I think, I'm not going to go through all 15 of them, but I shall deliver from purgatory those who have been devoted to the rosary. All those who propagate the Holy Rosary shall be aided by me in their necessities. All who recite the rosary are my sons and brothers of my only son, Christ. I mean, and that's kind of, that's coming right from Mary, you know, and I've always, you know, I just can't imagine my faith journey without, you know, the novenas and without the rosary. I don't even know, Mike, maybe, do you know how many different novenas are there?
Joe, I don't know.
But there's probably three or four that I, you know, throughout the calendar year that I'm, you know, I certainly dial into the surrender novena, you know, trying to do that often because that's such an Achilles heel of mine. But, I mean, it's amazing, like, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, the graces that we get for intercession, and we're told that, like, you know, hey, if anybody's got, you know, her son's ear, it's going to be her. You know, so certainly, you know, using her as best we can. And also, too, I mean, in her humanity, I mean, certainly born without sin, but, like, you know, had you know, I think I keep coming back to, you know, the wedding of Cana, you know, Christ's first miracle. And I've always struggled with that interpretation in the sense that, like, he says, woman, my time has not yet come. And she's like, okay. And then she goes to the servants, hey, do whatever he tells you to do.
Yeah.
So here's, you know, the God man, as you were saying, here he is like saying, hey, it's not my time. And then her said, okay. And then her just kind of giving him that little oomph. Yeah, it's your time, son. This is it. And of course they go to him and he, you know, he does what his mother instructs, you know, and there's God, you know, there's still like, if God can listen to his mother, you know, and the authority of the position, certainly then we can intercede on.
Yeah. And you know, Joe, there's a beautiful, as you were just recounting that, you know, that first miracle, right. That in the second luminous mystery, the wedding at Cana. And, Archbishop Fulton Sheen has this beautiful, beautiful reflection, Joe, on the wedding at Cana. And what he reflected on was, he said, look, you know, Mary knew when she knew the significance of when she approached her son, and she knew that if she were to ask him to do this, that it was going to kick off a chain of events, Joe, because that's when his public ministry began. And so for 30 years, she lived with Christ, and she loved him. And while she knew in her heart, right, because of the prophecy of Simeon, she knew that he was going to be a contradiction to the world, and that he was going to be rejected, and that a sword was going to pierce her heart. But for 30 years, they lived, you know, in relative, you know, peace and harmony and in love. But it was through when he kicked off his ministry, right, at the age of 30, and that was the first miracle. That was when it began. Yep. And she did that on our behalf because she didn't want the bride and the groom to be embarrassed. So she, sure. Again, what Fulton Sheen speaks to is the sacrifice of Mary, because she knew that what she was asking of her son, there were going to be consequences.
Sure. And even her, like, I mean, as you're saying that, I'm reminded of her surrender, right? I mean, you know, her yes. You know, is there any greater, she was certainly, you know, born without sin, but, you know, human nonetheless. And you know, like, her just, I'm the handmaid of the Sacred Heart, I'm the handmaid, you know, Lord, let it be done to me according to your will. I mean, and you know, and as, oh, by the way, a single woman who's, you know, barely a teenager, you know, but her, like, her yes, you know, hopefully inspires my yes. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Agreed, Coach. Yeah, I mean, it's about, I love that. I think, Joe, I think that's the message, right, is that, and maybe getting back to your initial question of a few moments ago, why Mary? Well, yes, as a mediatrix, yes, as an intercessor, but also he serves as the model for subordinating our will to the divine will.
No doubt.
Right? And it all comes down to that. It's all about, that's how you get to heaven, right, is not my will, your will, Lord. And Mary's entire life, that's what it was about.
Amen. So true. Listen, Mike, I do want to get to, before we close today, we certainly have some time here, but I want to talk about your new role with the Diocese of Boston. So what is your official title with that?
Yeah, thanks, Coach. So I am an adjunct formator.
Okay.
And so what the just very quickly, kind of treetop level here. So this is you know, guidance that was forthcoming from the Vatican, but it's essentially asking the seminaries across the globe to look at an additional year of seminary instruction and formation, and it's called the propedeutic year. And so they gave the guidance was forthcoming like last year. And they gave, you know, these seminaries an opportunity over the course of a year to kind of design how they were going to do this. And I think that, you know, there's each of the different dioceses, certainly here in the United States, it's taking on different shapes and forms. But what I can tell you, what Boston has done.
Let me ask you this, Mike. Is there, and we'll get into this deeper in a second, but I just want to make sure.
Sorry.
Is there uniformity within the final year based on the diocese? Do you understand what I'm asking? Do all seminarians from the Diocese of Boston have a similar script to follow in that final year, or does that vary seminarian to seminarian?
Okay, so thank you for the clarification. It actually, Coach, it's an additional year, but it's the first year.
Okay.
So they're front loading it. So I think it's essentially, and Coach, I would be misleading you if I said I knew what the criteria was. We have four men in the propedeutic year this year. And
okay.
So I think it's an assessment that, hey, these individual men, they need a little bit more greening. And, you know, we want to give them an additional year to build capacity and to maybe to discern a little bit more before we bring them into what had been the initial and the first year of seminary study.
I got you. Now, I'm assuming with your resume and your for lack of a better term, your doctrine in leadership throughout your entire career, what was the selection process for those men who were now helping with formation? How did Colonel Mike Manning, how was he selected?
Yeah, okay, and so Coach, are you talking about what does the leadership team look like?
So they said, okay, we're going to do this, and then, you know, they call Mike Manning, they involve him, was your primary or your sole your credential based on your leadership and your servant leadership model, or how did they select you to get involved with this group of men?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and again, I think your question kind of gets at my comment of a few moments ago, where I think, you know, it's each of the different dioceses, right, are building their approach to the propedeutic year in a way that's going to best kind of represent the charism of the individual diocese. So I think I got selected because of the work that, you know, that I've had the great honor of being able to do over the course of the last, you know, 10 years. In the diocese, exactly. Working with seminarians, you know, whether it's, you know, running the summer retreat or doing the ongoing formation for the young padres, or coming in and talking to the Theology 2 guys about how to be a good teammate. So I think I was selected because of, yeah, the leadership piece, Joe, and just this idea of, hey, look, you know, perhaps Manning might be able to posit some ideas relative to becoming a better teammate.
Man, and kudos to the church for seeing that as a necessity too. And I would hope that, I've often, and again, not being critical, but I've often said, like, they have, you know, these men are brilliant men, and their faith is like so strong. I've been a little critical, like, in terms of who's forming them from a leadership standpoint, from an inclusivity standpoint, from a teammate standpoint. And that's pretty awesome that the church is, even things like, you know, tying it all together on a Sunday, right? Or, knowing that we're all coming from so many different places in the journey, right? When we congregate together at a 10 o'clock mass or a 5 p.m. mass, but just able to give people something to sink their teeth into. So, I would think that there's going to be at least themes, Mike, or lanes that will cross over from diocese to diocese. No, you think?
100%. Yeah. No. And Coach, great comment. And there is. I mean, the Vatican, kudos to them. They put out some great guidance, and then I think the USCCB also put out subsequent guidance that nests with, that's consonant with what, you know, the Vatican had put out. And so there will be these lanes, and I think, you know, these lines of effort, if you will. You did speak to it, and you certainly alluded to it. You know, one of the things that I've assessed, and this is with humility, I'm going to share this with you, and this is not casting aspersions. You know, I think, you know, leadership is hard, right? It's hard.
No, no.
And
it's harder tight, now and than it's probably hard. Ever before, I think.
Yes. It's hard.
Do you know why? Because there's fewer followers.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, and,
that's
and,
my
yeah,
opinion.
Yeah. 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 Fewer followers. And then, Joe, everything is contested these days, right? It's not just the approach. It's like, we, what's the truth? Right. You know,
well, and then even then, Mike, and I don't mean to interrupt you because I definitely want to hear your point, but like that's the ultimate, Rob, right? It's like there's no more, like, truth is now relative, even within the faith journey.
Yes.
You know
yes.
what I mean? Because we have
yes.
people like, you know, like we have people that identify and check the same box of denomination that you and I check, but we're sitting here saying, man, we couldn't be further from one another in terms of ideology, dogma, doctrine, all of it. Mm. But But good, I interrupt you. I'm sorry about that.
No. But the coach, that's it. I mean, what you just said is so powerful. It's, you know, and so you can imagine, right? If depending on who's delivering the curriculum, you're going to get how are we catechizing? How are we building these young Padres, right? Or soon to be Padres? How are we building these seminarians? And so, I mean, I think, and I would imagine, right? Because we're there is division, and I think the way that the truth is interpreted and the way that it's communicated, that seminarians in X seminary, vice seminarians in Y seminary are probably getting very, very different interpretations of what the truth is and how to live the truth and how to defend the truth. And so, again, I feel very grateful. I'm very, very grateful. And I feel, Joe, if I could do this full time, I would. But I feel that, you know, what a beautiful mission to be part of. And I'm part of this great team. They put the guy that's running it, Joe, is a, you'd like him. They're all Irishmen. Okay. So this is not to ostracize.
I like him already.
Your listeners. Yeah. This is a true story. It's Lynch. It's two Padres by the name of McInnes. And Manning. And that's a true story. Two Padres named McInnes. They're separated in age by about 30 years. No relation. But Dr. Lynch is a social worker, so he's working with the men on their origin story and kind of, you know, really doing a beautiful exploration of kind of, you know, who am I and what was, you know, the impact of my, you know, my experience in my family. Manning's doing the leadership development stuff, and then the priests, these two wonderful priests, are doing faith formation. And I think it's a high touch program, Joe. But I think it may evolve in such a way that it's going to be really impactful for these guys.
Oh my gosh, on so many, it's so many layers to that. Now let me say something. Like that's kind of that's a tremendous compliment that you were included in that, and especially because. You know, it's your involvement is exponential. Like you're going to touch present Catholics, fallen away Catholics, future Catholics, because of your ability to influence tomorrow's leaders. You know, within our church. How much? Is it pretty labor intensive for that? It sounds like it's a 4-man team, Mike, or five.
Yeah. So we've got it's again really high touch coach. So there's four of us. And then we get the men. The way it works is that I, on average, I'm with them 2 to 3 Mondays a month. Okay.
Wow, so, that's pretty long.
What's that, Coach?
That's intense. I mean, that's a
yeah, it is. Oh yeah, no, it's a cup. So it's this coming not today, but this coming Monday, a week from today. I'll get them for 2 hours, and then I have them the following week for 2 hours. And when Manning's not there, Dr. Lynch is there, my colleague, who's a wonderful man, wonderful, wonderful man. And then the two Padres are doing the faith formation. So that's the formation team. And then on top of that, these guys are taking class as well at the seminary or at Boston College. So I think it is intensive, but it's not meant to – this is something, the way we're structuring this, Joe, is that we want this to be something that they enjoy. And the way that we're kind of framing this is that, look, you're a subunit. You four men are a subunit. We want you to build, you know, psychological safety and trust among yourselves. And, oh, by the way, recognize that you're part of something bigger than yourselves. You're part of the house within the seminary writ large. So we're going to be very deliberate, Joe, about bringing in some of the older guys, some of the seminarians that have been there that are, you know, have matriculated through the first couple, 2-3 years of the seminary. So we want to bring these guys into the fold. It's about team. It's about family. And then within that construct, that framework, what does it look like to be a good teammate? How do you hold each other accountable? And then how do you support each other?
And that's gotta be like, amazingly powerful for these men who I think oftentimes don't know exactly what's being asked of them, you know, even up to ordination. You know what I mean? Like, just in terms of, you know, the how, you know, and I'm not talking about, you know, I think, you know, 35 years ago, there was a, you know, a social status that accompanied this commitment to the clergy.
Yeah.
And now it's almost like, you know, you have to, because it is a lonely life, and you have come under scrutiny, and, you know, with some of the, you know, mismanagement or scandals that have attacked us,
right,
you know, from the outside. Right. So it's like, you know, you have to now, like, it's almost like we're, you know, I do like it because it's a contraction, right? The reality is fewer men and women are entering the religious life. Yet we're still adding a layer to ensure that, A, they're ready to lead and to be knowledgeable and to unify or galvanize, and B, it's a chance for them to, you know, not only are you, you know, is it, I don't want to call it a filtering out or a screening, but it's like, it's a deeper drill down. You know what I mean? I think in a lot of ways it's equipping, you know, I've said before, like, you know, who's, you know, a lot of times, especially now more than ever, these guys go through an incredibly intense preparation academically and, you know, and then all the way up through ordination. And then it's like, I know even things like, you know, Villanova now has a church management program, like, you know, the corporate side of church, right? Like, you have to, you know, you don't want to admit it, but you have to keep the heat on. You have to keep the roof over the head. You have to pay the bills. Right. You got to pay for a massive undertaking financially. You have to, you know, so you have that in addition to, oh, I got to feed my souls, you know, three, four, five masses a weekend and potentially four or five more throughout the week. So how am I better equipped to do that? Was the intention of this additional year, Mike, was it to prepare them from a commitment standpoint, or was it to give them an opportunity to bring people and keep people on the vine and in the faith?
You know, Joe, I think it's all the above. You know, I think there was a recognition then, and you touched upon it. I mean, Joe, everything's harder, right? It's harder to be a teacher. It's
a father.
It's harder to be
all of it.
A parent, exactly. Yeah. It's harder to be. It's harder to lead today than it's certainly been in our lifetime, right? So I think there was a recognition that, hey, we got to give these guys some additional tools, but beyond that, Joe, you know, it's about. It's what I think it also does. I think it, as you alluded to and spoke to, it serves as a retention tool. But what I like, and I want to pull that thread, and you, as you laid it out, you know, a generation or two or three ago, you know, there was social status that went with this, and you know, the way that Americans lived our values was very, very differently, right? And you know, it's gotten harder. I mean, today, the world has always rejected the truth. But Joe, it's rejected in every turn, and so these guys, and this is for all of us that are in leadership positions. But I think the Padres, in particular, no Padres, no sacrament. We got to give them everything they need to be successful. But beyond that, this idea of community, Joe, right? You know, a generation or two ago, they would be living in a home with two or three or four other Padres.
No doubt.
And now, you're in a collaborative where you, if you're lucky, you might have a parochial vicar, but most of these guys are by themselves. So
amen.
It's a very lonely life, right? How do we prepare these guys?
Amen. Well, I know this much, brother. You're doing God's work, man, and I love you for that. All right, my friend. Until the next time, God bless. Folks, have a great week. We'll talk next week. All the best. God bless. Take care.
God bless you. Thanks, sir. I'm longing for your ways. I'm waiting for the day. So
me return to you again. And Lord,